The Grateful Dead aren't just a band, they're a phenomenon. They were probably the most celebrated psychedelic band of the 60s. They've been together for more than 22 years, and throughout that time they've had a following of fans, deadheads, so loyal they've made it their life's work to follow the Dead on the road. Mickey Hart is one of the Dead's two drummers. He joined the band in 1967. But playing with the Dead is just one aspect of his musical life. While traveling with the Dead around the world, Hart has taped singers and musicians from Africa, India, and the Middle East. Now that there's a growing interest in world music, Hart has produced his recordings from the 70s and 80s into a series of CDs on the Ryko disc label. The series includes Hart's 1978 recording of Nubian singer, songwriter, and oud player Humza Eldin. I got a corny. Has it been touring around the world with the Grateful Dead that's introduced you to a lot of the musicians who
no,
you've recorded?
No, not really. Mostly it was the Folkways collection that when I was a kid, I listened to a lot of these world music collections, and it brought the world into my living room, and it brought it alive. And that's where, and also the music on the streets, the Latin music, was what first gave me a hit of Western, of non-Western music, of third world music.
So while you were touring with the Dead, you were able to go to the musicians of different countries and see them perform.
That's right.
Would you have to get to know somebody pretty well before being able to record them?
Oh, yes. You have to hang out, and you have to take part in the local customs. And so you have to have a stomach for this. This is something that is not what you want to do every day unless you really wanted to do it. It takes patience. There's it's very time-consuming.
How are the recordings that you made in the 70s and 80s released now on Ryko disc? What's the story behind that?
Well, it began in the early 70s with my interest in Naga recording and also seeing all the world music passing in front of me not being recorded. So I just ran tape. It was actually very selfish in those days. I just wanted a great recording of the world's music to listen to at night. It was curl up with a cup of cognac or something and sit up there, and it was sort of my wine cellar, my chateau, you know. And then, of course, a lot of these musics became so rare that they disappeared or on the endangered music list. And with the ecology being as frail as it is, these musics are attached to it, you know, to the rainforest. When a rainforest goes, the music of the rainforest goes. So now it's becoming more valuable because it's rarer. And it's become, people want to hear it now, and that's why I released it.
How has your exposure to world music changed your playing as a drummer and percussionist?
Oh, geez, it's hard to describe. I mean, in every which way you can imagine. You know, my sensibilities are completely different now than when I came out of school. I mean, I've learned to listen and play from a spiritual side and not necessarily a technical side. So, I mean, it's affected me deep, not only in my technique, but in the sensibility in which I approach the music.
One of the recordings on the Ryko disc series is of your group, the Digga Rhythm Band, which, give us an idea of who's on it.
Oh, Digga was the maestro, Zakir Hussain, who's Alaraka's son, and about the finest percussionist on the planet now. And we put this together in the mid-70s, and it's a sort of a 20th century gamelan made of tuned percussion from all over the world, and this was this is the jewel of the collection, one of the jewels.
And what are you playing on this?
Oh, I play timpani, traps, drum set, dozens of instruments.
Been playing with rock groups for over 20 years now.
Way over 20
years.
Oh, yeah.
How does it affect your hearing? Especially as the drummer, you're kind of in the middle of the loudest part.
You might say I'm in the middle of a lot of stuff. Well, there are certain frequencies in my hearing that aren't as sharp as others. After a tour, it takes me a while. I read lips for about a week or so. And then it goes away, and then I'm pretty normal. But there are a few places in my hearing that have cuts and dropout, and I'm aware of them, and I take them into consideration. Like little birdies up in the tree way far away are a little hard for me to hear sometimes. But then I can hear up to 18,000 cycles, 19,000 cycles.
Does this ever interfere with either your ability to hear more quiet musicians play or your ability to mix stuff?
Not the quiet. The quiet part, I can my ears tune in and they focus on the quiet. See, in the Grateful Dead, it's huge volume. I'll admit there is lots of volume, but it's really clean. There's no square waves. There's no distortion. Everything is pure. So you can take a lot of volume, and if the sound is pure and not distorted, and you know, with whining guitars, all of our guitars just are very crystal, and they all sing, and they're all in tune, and it's a very pristine sound, even though it comes to you at 140, 130 dB.
Your father managed the band for a short time.
That's right.
In 1970, I think he joined. How did that happen that your father became the band's manager?
Well, we really weren't into the business. We never really looked at the business, and we were failing miserably. We were owing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And my father had business experience, even though he was a crook. Of course, I didn't know that then. And he was the only one around that knew how to sign a check or anything. Or really, you know, we just went into playing. We were just mad kids, you know, just trying to play music every minute of the day. And we just didn't want to be bothered by by the world. So he managed us, and of course, turned out that he was a crook and stole lots of money from the band. And, you know, it's just a big, horrible story.
Well, when he left the band, the Dead put out a warrant for his arrest for embezzling, didn't they?
No, the police did. It wasn't
the police
did.
I'm sorry.
No, the Grateful Dead don't put people in jail. He just stole money. You know, I mean, it wasn't like he killed us or anything. So they prosecuted him. It wasn't the band.
Uh-huh. Were you embarrassed?
Embarrassed? That's one way to put it. I was disgraced. Actually, it was disgraceful. You know, that your father should steal from his son, especially from the Grateful Dead, which was like Santa Claus. Grateful Dead never hurt anybody. He was just a crook. He just happened to be my father.
So
you can't choose your father.
How did that change your relationship with him?
Oh, well, I never saw him again, you know, until he died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I buried him, and that was that.
Huh. You left the band shortly after he did, right?
That's right.
Was it because of
that was a big part of it.
Yeah.
It made me feel real bad, but my brothers never really blamed me for it, but I was sort of shamed, and I just sort of hunkered off to my barn, and I built my recording studio and did Rolling Thunder and learned how to engineer and put together my own personal music and found out what I sounded like beside the Grateful Dead. And then when I had enough of that, I walked back into the Grateful Dead and assumed the position.
So in a way it worked out for you.
Oh, it worked out fine. Mm-hmm. Everything works out, always works out.
Why did you rejoin the Dead?
Because they're my band, you know, I mean, because I couldn't stand being without it, and they needed me, and I needed them. That's why I joined back. We didn't really join. It's not like you sign in or out of the Grateful Dead. You either are or you're not. It's not one of those things that, you know, you sign up or you sign out.
The Dead is one of the few rock bands with two drummers in it. How do you coordinate that?
Well, you coordinate it from the heart, you know. Billy and I are tied by the heart, you know, and we really love each other as human beings, and also our styles are completely different, so we don't compete with each other, and there's no competition, and it's sort of like a marriage. And the thing that we do collectively is more powerful than the thing we do individually.
Were you in a period with the Grateful Dead ever of doing like a whole lot of drugs while performing?
Oh,
of taking a lot of acid.
Of course, the Grateful Dead collectively did psychedelics in the early days, and that was one of the things that based its music on, the collective experience of psychedelics.
When did you stop using psychedelics?
In the 70s.
What was the reason for stopping?
Well, it's really hard to take care of the kids high on acid and stuff, you know. You know what I mean? It's just not done. It's irresponsible. And with the family and with other responsibilities. And once you've been there, you've been there. And it just was going back to the same old place. And when we took psychedelics, it was more of a sacrament. You know, it was trying to find a higher order. It wasn't going ya-ya in the trees, you know, in the woods, just going out there and partying at the beach with beer. I mean, the only time we did it was when we played, and it was a sort of like church to us. It was like that kind of experience.
Do you expect the dead to stay together for years to come?
Oh, I think so. I think as long as that we're up and we love to play, it'll stay together as long as we're healthy. I would like to turn the clock myself. I would like to take this into the 2000. That's sort of what I had in mind. But you never can tell. I mean, the Grateful Dead is a gigantically strong thing, but it's also like walking on eggshells. You know, it's very delicate. So we'll see.